Biden has basically floated plans of having 100% carbon-free electricity by 2035, which is very exciting. As you know, California's goal is 2045, so he's putting the federal government on a faster track than California, which is commendable. And also, he has talked about clean transportation and electric cars, and you may have seen the announcements from both Ford and GE that starting in 2030 and 2035, they'll be producing electric vehicles only.
Welcome to Let's Talk Change. Human history is a long series of adaptations to disruptive change. The impact of innovation and scalability of today's technologies is powerful. They either deteriorate or improve living conditions on Earth. In this podcast series, we sit down with decision makers, innovators, experts, and visionaries to discuss how technologies, business innovations, policies, and improved communication can drive the change we need to amplify sustainable behavior in business and politics, for the benefit of the people and the planet.
My name is David Waterman. In this episode of Let's Talk Change, we have a novelty. We have invited a guest to join us twice, Angelina Galiteva. She is the chairwoman of one of the largest energy grid operators in the United States and globally, the California Independent System Operator, CAISO. Right after Joe Biden got elected as the new president of the United States in November 2020, I discussed with Angelina what we can expect from the new Biden administration in terms of energy transition and with regards to the fight against climate change. Since then, Biden has come into office and he kept his promise to rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement. If he is on track with his climate and energy agenda, I will review with Angelina Galiteva now on a regular basis. This episode is our first check-in. However, we will start this episode first with the review of what actually has happened in Texas this February and what are the main learnings and consequences from the largest power outage in the history of the state of Texas. Listen and enjoy.
Hi, Angelina Galiteva. It's really great to talk to you again. How are you?
I am good. Thank you, David. How are you doing?
Good, good. I remember the last time we talked was around the election of the new president of the United States, Joe Biden. And this is now a couple of weeks and actually a month ago. Since then, President Biden has taken office, but also a few things have happened over in the United States. And last time we discussed a little bit that we should follow the new administration and what's going on actually in the United States is the largest economy in the world and how well you're doing in terms of the energy transition towards 100% renewable energy, but also, of course, in terms of climate protection laws and policies. So what has happened since then? I mean, a couple of weeks ago, there was a major incident in Texas, right? So what has happened?
Well, so what happened in Texas, and as a grid operator, it was pretty unnerving for me because being the chair of the California ISO and seeing how ERCOT, the grid operator in Texas, failed was very worrisome. And especially when rumors started to circulate forward that wind power, for some strange reason, has caused the outage, and it was immediately blamed on renewables and with the subtext of we shouldn't be transitioning to renewables because all of these renewables are unreliable. Now, several things happen in Texas, and we have to be aware of the peculiarities of Texas. Texas is its own state in the sense that it is not interconnected by the grid to any of the neighboring states. So it is completely isolated. They do not import power or export power. They're their own balancing authority. And they did this because they didn't want to be regulated by the federal government. So in order to have state authority, Texas isolated itself and islanded itself out. So when their infrastructure started to fail because of the coal, there weren't any neighboring states, including California, who could have wheeled power over to Texas that could help them because it was impossible to do. So Texas failed on several levels. One, they failed because even though they had had cold weather before in 1986 and in 2008 and in 2011, and they were told that they need to insulate their infrastructure, they didn't. They didn't interconnect to other states, so they couldn't bring power in. And the infrastructure that failed, ironically, was the gas infrastructure because the gas pipelines froze, the nuclear infrastructure because the instruments froze and the water froze and they couldn't utilize it, and the coal infrastructure because the coal piles as well as the instruments also froze. So it was the fossil infrastructure that failed. The reason that some of the wind turbines stopped working was because they didn't have the winter package. They never thought that it would get that cold in Texas. And the issue was it foreseeable or not? And technically, because of the cold snaps that they had had, especially in 2011, it was foreseeable that they would have weather that was just as cold. And, you know, it's not just the energy infrastructure that failed in Texas. It's also the water infrastructure, right? Because their pipes are not insulated. They've got burst pipes everywhere and people still having no access to water. And that happened in Mississippi as well. Even though Mississippi insulated their energy infrastructure, they didn't insulate their pipes. And thousands of people in Mississippi right now have no access to clean drinking water because the pipes burst. I guess 96 pipes burst or something like that. So that's a tragedy in Mississippi too that we're just starting to hear about after Texas calmed down a little bit. So big mistakes in Texas. First and foremost, the first lesson is renewables did not cause the problem. It was the fossil industry, and it was actually the mismanagement of the Texas utilities and infrastructure that is the main root cause for what happened. And with climate change, and there's a lot of climate deniers in Texas, making weather extremes much more possible in terms of both heat and cold, they need to be better prepared to be able to handle the fluctuations of temperature. And we have to do the same for California. We had extreme conditions this past summer, and we're working very hard to make sure that if something similar were to happen again this year, we are well prepared to ride through it and not have issues. Our solution is different. In California, we're going full speed ahead with renewables. We believe they're the way to a more resilient and reliable system.
So just to understand the Texas case correctly, so it basically came down to the root cause that a couple of years ago, the energy market was deregulated. So the utilities didn't have the incentive to do the proper investments into isolation. And now the winter, because of climate change, probably became a lot more harsher. And the isolation didn't make sure that the fossil fuel and nuclear power stations were running correctly. So the system broke down.
Right. They weren't prepared for cold weather.
So what about the windmills in Texas? Did they also stop or?
Yes, they stopped again because they didn't buy the winter package, which is the right lubricants to be able to run in winter, so the lubricants froze. But as you know, they run in the North Sea, they run in Iowa, they run in Norway. When you have the right equipment, it's like going and driving in snow without snow tires. You don't do that. But also, the problem with Texas was the regulatory frameworks. The regulatory frameworks did not require keeping the infrastructure, and they also did not require enough reserves. So they didn't have reserves.
So, but still conservative politicians, as I understand, are currently blaming the renewables for this power outages. But as you said, this is not the root cause.
Yeah, not at all. And renewables in Texas are less than 10%. The failure was on a massive scale. So it couldn't be renewables by any stretch of the imagination. It's just bad politics and bad faith in terms of not saying exactly what happened and telling us what the truth is or telling the public. So that was very, very disturbing to hear coming out of Texas all the way from the governor.
All right. So deregulation seems to be the root cause. Is this the main lesson to learn from Texas now? And is this something which you think should be done differently, for example, as in California, as you said?
I think several main lessons. One, deregulation, but deregulation also with the agencies having enough authority to mandate, like in California, they will mandate that infrastructure be maintained. They didn't in Texas. In Texas, it was a recommendation and not a mandate, which is a problem because you need to recover it from the rates if you're doing those upgrades. So you need to have the requirement to do that. And also they didn't have enough reserves and they didn't have enough insulated facilities that will allow them to maintain the reserves as needed. So that was a big problem in Texas. Bad planning, not just deregulation, bad planning, and then isolating themselves from the rest of the state so they couldn't bring any power in from outside. Because down in El Paso was a pocket where they had energy, but El Paso is interconnected to the neighboring grid. That's why they had energy. So it can be done. Texas just chose not to do it. And I'm hoping that they change their plans and start becoming better good grid citizens and interconnecting to their neighbors, just like California has. We're all interconnected and we benefit from the ability to help each other out and support each other's systems and operations.
So of what you know from a different part in the United States currently as well, do you think that something similar can happen in other regions in the United States, like what just has happened in Texas? So this is a wake-up call to everybody? Or do you think this was more exceptional?
Well, I don't think it will be the extent of Texas, because Texas does have the unique situation of no reserves in isolation. But I also think that it's important to realize that with climate change, we're going to have greater extremes, right? On the East Coast, we have hurricanes that can interfere with the operation of infrastructure. On the West Coast, we can have fires and we can have heat waves. And what we learned last summer from California is when you have a heat wave that is very unusual, where the temperatures in Los Angeles are 105 degrees, in Las Vegas are 120, and in Seattle, it's 110, which never happens, but that dried up the hydropower from being able to support other states. So we do see hot weather in California and throughout the West, but never such a big, huge heat wave across such a wide region that caused problems all around. So we need to be prepared to understand that this can happen and have the resiliency built into the system to be able to operate in such constrained conditions.
And as you correctly said, due to the weather extremes, we need to have a more resilient energy system. And you probably could make the argument that a more decentralized system, which by nature is a renewable energy system, is probably a more resilient system.
It would have helped a lot. So if we had had more storage in basin, for instance, and been able to island out certain territories with microgrids, that would have allowed us to operate. But again, the lesson we learned in California was not that renewables failed. Renewables operated, and renewables operated as expected. What we had was this unprecedented heat wave. And when it's really hot outside, gas plants operate at a lower capacity just because they lower their efficiency during hot weather. And we had gas plants go offline, one small one unexpectedly, but another one that had been there for scheduled maintenance, which was supposed to come back online before August, but it didn't. So we didn't have the power that we usually would have had within California to be able to operate the grid. Again, the margins were lower than they should have been. We're increasing the reserve margins as well, and also ensuring that we have more storage and more local generation that can support the grid when you've got shortages and when you've got peak demand across the West. So lessons learned are there. And it's not that renewables didn't perform. On the contrary, it's the fact that renewables did perform. It's the fossil industry that needs to be more resilient.
So what about the grid system itself? I mean, you are the chairwoman of one of the largest independent grid system operators in the United States, from CAISO, the California Independent System Operator. So what are your experiences here? Should the United States be more interconnected or should have more isolated, well, let's call it cells?
Well, we should all be interconnected to the extent that we can have regional integration, even a national grid as a backbone. So having the ability to move power around larger geographic territories, kind of on a horizontal level, is very important for reliability and for having access to energy to optimize and balance the grid as a whole. But also the so-called vertical integration, where you're going deeper into the communities and being able to take a certain community and make it self-sufficient, that helps the grid on two levels. It helps by being able to take that load out. So if you have a grid that needs to shed load, which we needed to, and that's why the energy efficiency programs were so good, is that we were able to pull out 3,000 megawatts just by issuing a flex alert and saying, use less power. So on the demand side, if you can reduce the demand, that's great as well. Or isolate certain territories where they're not interconnected to the larger grid, so they're not stressing it, but they're independent and operating and sufficient in and of themselves as well. And that will help in a twofold way. One, it will help when we have situations like we had last summer where the grid is stressed, so you can shed some load while the customers are still getting services, which is great. But also during fires, because when we have a fire, for public safety shutoffs, we sometimes close down the large power lines to a certain area so that it doesn't cause a spark that causes a fire. So if you're shutting down a certain area because for safety concerns, if that area has a microgrid and it's distributed and it can support itself, then it's much easier to ride through these events as well. And people are not upset that they don't have power for several days because of safety concerns. I think that is something that California is going to be looking at a lot more in the future. And that's on the distribution level to ensure that customers can reliably be disconnected from the grid while they still have local microgrids and distributed systems supporting the community.
Can you give us, before we move on and talk a little bit more about the federal level, can you tell us a little bit more about what are the economic consequences in Texas right now? I mean, over here in Europe, we hear that costs went up to $9,000 per megawatt hour, which really drove whole, you know, companies into insolvencies.
Yes, and customers. I mean, there's individual customers for a week's worth of energy receiving bills of $17,000, $9,000, $10,000. I mean, these are individual homeowners. It's like incredible amounts of money, and people cannot afford to pay that. It's not only going to drive companies out of business, it will bankrupt families. So apart from the humanitarian tragedy, it's also a financial mess of gargantuan proportions. I mean, people died from steel poisoning. There's heartbreaking stories about three little children and their grandmother being poisoned by, you know, steel gas because they left the fireplace running or they brought in a barbecue to keep warm. People died from cold and hypothermia. This should not be happening in the greatest economy of the world. I mean, this is really, really embarrassing.
So are there any consequences already? Are politicians taking responsibilities? Do they learn from what happened, or is this too early for them to draw consequences?
You know, Ted Cruz and Republican politicians are just finger pointing and claiming that this isn't anything that they were involved in. I think we need a little bit more time to decide where the actual responsibility is. And there's going to be a lot of finger pointing, as I said, and that's going to continue. But I think the lessons learned, especially for us in California and other states that are looking at climate change seriously, is that we need to make our infrastructure more resilient. That these are changes that are going to be happening. We need to be anticipating them and making sure that we are prepared for what is foreseeable, and Texas was foreseeable, but more importantly, thinking ahead and being prepared for what we don't see right now, for the unforeseeable, and ensuring that we've got enough of a resiliency built into our infrastructure to be able to handle those problems to the extent possible.
Let's move on to the federal level. Joe Biden is in office now, and one of the first things he did was to rejoin the Paris Agreement. And so the United States is back in the international community. I think except of Iran, there's probably no other country currently left on this. So welcome back to the world community of those trying to fight the climate change challenge. What else has he done since he has taken office?
Yes, thank goodness for that and for becoming a part of the international community, for respecting science and for actually allowing science to lead on all levels, not just climate change and understanding that climate change is an existential crisis, but also COVID and allowing science to lead on COVID and having common sense measures in order to be able to defeat that disease, which of course is also a part of the package of the changing environment. What he's also said is that he wants to decarbonize the economy to the large extent in the United States as well. I mean, California is committed to decarbonizing the economy, but Biden now has brought the whole of the United States to that level and saying that the future is in new green jobs. Actually, at the Department of Energy, they created a new position, which is the Director of Green Jobs Development. And happy to say that a very good friend of mine, I think you know her, Jennifer Kropke, got that job. So that's really exciting as well. He has appointed Jennifer Granholm as the head of DOE, and she is very much in favor of electric transportation, renewable energy, decarbonization programs, and sees the future as the most valuable infrastructure that we can be investing in is renewable. And we need to be moving in that direction. So Biden has basically floated plans of having 100% carbon-free electricity by 2035, which is very exciting. As you know, California's goal is 2045. So he's putting the federal government on a faster track than California, which is commendable. And also he has talked about clean transportation and electric cars. And you may have seen the announcements from both Ford and GE that starting in 2030 and 2035, they'll be producing electric vehicles only. And in California, we have a mandate that after 2035, there will be a ban on the sale of internal combustion engines. So by transforming both the electricity sector towards renewables and then utilizing that renewable energy to charge emission-free electric vehicles, you're taking a big portion of the industry that are the greenhouse gas emitting industries and transitioning them on a very fast and accelerated schedule to carbon free. And that is certainly very, very commendable. And I hope we're very successful and very organized and purposeful in pursuing those goals. I think the technology is there. The cost curves are there. We now have the political will, which is extremely important. The devil is always in the detail, which is now we need to focus on implementation.
There is the language of emission-free electricity by 2035. What does it really mean? Is the Biden administration talking about 100% renewable energy, or is there also a certain, element and still, discussions around nuclear energy? As we know, Bill Gates is currently pushing the next generation of nuclear energy as well. Is this something being taken seriously? What is your take on that subject?
From a practical point of view, I don't think it is a serious discussion. And as we saw, one of the big failures, unforeseeable big failures here in California, was the Sun and Offer nuclear power station that after a $700 million upgrade started having radiation leaks and had to be permanently closed down. And now we have to continue paying for it, not only for that $700 million of investment as ratepayers, but also for the security of the site because all of the waste is stored there. And it's going to be dangerous and radioactive, as we all know, for the next 50,000 years. So until nuclear solves the issue of the nuclear waste, it's a non-starter. It's too expensive, it's too slow, it's too dangerous. And it really makes no sense from a flexibility requirement because nuclear power is not flexible. And all we need really to operate a grid is flexibility, power that can ramp up fast and ramp down based on the output of renewables and variable energy. So we've got a mix of technologies right now that can allow us to operate a grid reliably without nuclear, which is expensive and dangerous. I am really mystified as to why Bill Gates is pushing for that. I see him on TV and it always makes me very upset because clearly he's not talking to grid operators. Grid operators will tell him that nuclear power is pretty much the most useless source of energy for a high penetration of renewables grid. You don't need it. It doesn't provide any help or support whatsoever,
right?
Which is why we're shutting down the last nuclear power station in California in 2024. It's phased out for economic and operational reasons, just because it's not useful.
And that's something which you think is also recognized by Joe Biden and his team? Or
I think so, and I hope so, because once you start looking at the practicality of designing a nuclear power station, building a nuclear power station, permitting a nuclear power station, operating a nuclear power station, figuring out what you do with the waste, it's going to take you 12 years to build it. It makes no sense. We don't have time for this. Meanwhile, renewables, you can scale up and you can build very quickly because they don't utilize water. There's no pipeline issue whatsoever for the fuel in terms of having to secure fuel like the nuclear fuels, whatever they may be, whatever form they are. There's no waste issue and there's no safety issue. So, I mean, we can play politics with nuclear and talk about it. I hope that we don't, but apparently some conversations are taking place, especially because of Bill Gates, and somebody needs to talk to him and have him see the light. Or we can basically say, we've got the technologies, we've got storage solutions, we've got a good mix of renewable solutions, we've got transmission solutions, and we've got integration solutions that allow us to pursue 100% carbon-free energy right now. I mean, as you know well, the hydrogen pathway too, the hydrogen pathway is much more resilient and much more cost effective than any nuclear solution.
Talking about how Joe Biden is pushing through his agenda, I mean, since he has taken office, he has signed a number of executive orders already on the pause or moratorium on new oil and gas lease permits on federal lands and waters. He revoked the permit of the Keystone XL pipeline. Is he able to push through the climate policies and clean energy agenda just through executive orders, or does he still need to go through the House of Representatives and the Senate as well?
Well, hopefully you want to have it in legislation, and that makes it long-term, and that provides it longevity and a security for the future. Executive orders, as we all know, are from one president to the next. They're easy to implement, but they're also easy to reverse. So they're going to need to have an infrastructure package, and I hope they put it in as a Green Jobs Infrastructure Package and the New Deal, the New Green Deal, in terms of, look, we're going to have to change our infrastructure and build back better. And this false notion of saying, oh, it's going to cost $1 trillion to transition to renewables. Well, guess what? The status quo is going to cost $10 trillion. The status quo is much more expensive than transitioning to renewables. The problem is that is not the narrative out there, because transitioning to a new technology is going to cost X amount of dollars. But it's never followed by, however, maintaining the infrastructure of the existing technologies is going to cost much more. And then, you know, it starts to make sense to transition to the new because it's better, it's cheaper, it's more efficient, it's much more environmentally friendly, you don't have the environmental externalities, and it is the path forward for the future for the whole planet, not just for the United States, but the 2 billion people in sub-Saharan Africa that have no energy right now. So from an equity point of view, from a value proposition point of view, from an economic development and a jobs point of view, it's a no-brainer. The issue is that we're not hearing the narrative in that way. We're just hearing, oh, renewables are expensive, but we're not hearing the counter-argument as much, but the status quo is much more expensive. Right? And it kills me when that happens.
Okay, so I mean, this is obviously the, you know, more long-term objective to push or to put a lot of these things into legislation as well. Can you explain us over here in Europe a little bit as well how this is working now? I mean, in Georgia, looks like that luckily the majority have voted for this, you know, additional seats for the Democrats. So this also means that there is a better majority now in the Senate, right, for the Democrats?
Correct. Yes, and that's a good thing because the Democrats are consolidated around the vision of a greener future and better jobs. And to tell you the truth, I still am wondering what the Republican Party is consolidated against, apart from fear-mongering and basically saying that everything that is progressive and environmentally friendly is bad, and that climate change is not real, and that fossil energy is what's going to save us. I just don't understand their platform, if there even is a platform at this stage.
Right.
But it's encouraging to see that, you know, Arizona and Michigan and Georgia and Pennsylvania transition more towards the Democratic platform. It's a more centrist platform, but still, I think people understand instinctively the vision that, look, a job is a job, a good paying job is a good paying job. And if you can have a good paying job on the surface doing green technology, as opposed to being underground in the mines getting lung disease, why wouldn't you want the clean job? People want jobs. People want economic development. And the best way to get them high quality, good jobs is transitioning to an electrified renewable infrastructure. Because the reality is the jobs will be local, the manufacturing will be local. This will bring back manufacturing as well. You can have a versatile set of technologies creating the infrastructure of the future that is not only wires and generation connected, but electricity now is in the transportation sector, right? You're charging cars with electricity. You can use the batteries of the cars to support the grid. You have homes now, and there's a mandate in California as well that have storage as well as solar photovoltaics. So you can be generating, storing electricity, but also supporting the grid and getting paid for it. You have smart appliances. You've got infrastructures that before were never thought as part of an energy sector, like the building sector or the transportation sector, that have become an integral part of providing and using electricity. So it's a very, very exciting world that creates a lot of new jobs on the local level and incentivizes the local economies, while at the same time improving the environment.
So we could have realistic hopes that the climate change agenda will not divide that much the country and will be looked at differently from the Democratic or Republican perspective, but this could actually be a topic down the road where both Republicans and Democrats could join forces.
That is my hope, because this is a united front for a united future, not only in the United States, but globally. This is where we need to be focused as a whole, and it makes sense. I mean, the jobs in the fossil industry are on their way out. They're not going to be increasing, and it makes no sense to invest in something that doesn't provide the economic and environmental and social benefit as the new technologies, which are much more environmentally and climate friendly, and also socially friendly, and avoid not only environmental costs such as air and water pollution, but also healthcare costs, because we know pollution kills.
What are now the next immediate steps? It looks like Biden has pulled together a good team. You think the team is already up and running now, or are there still key positions to fill?
There's still key positions to be filled, but he's got good people in place for that, and they just need to be confirmed by the Senate. So I think very soon that will also finish, hopefully in the next couple of weeks, and he'll have his full cabinet and all of his heads of agencies appointed. I know that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has a good makeup now. The DOE is looking pretty good. So the resource agency is being filled in, but with, I think the head is going to be the first Native American woman, which is also very exciting. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at a very versatile, diverse cabinet of very competent people that rely on science, that see the future. And I'm hoping and I have faith that they're going to be able to execute a platform that brings us forward and establishes the United States yet again as a climate and technology leader, and not as a science denier focused on the past and not looking at the future. That they're going to be implementing the technologies that we need for us to be able to survive, frankly.
So what are the next concrete steps you're aware of what we can expect in terms of energy and climate policies coming from the Biden administration?
Well, I mean, I'd like to see the proposal for decarbonizing the electricity sector, which I think is foundational, because if you decarbonize the electricity sector and then you mandate an electric vehicle requirement, then, as I said before, you're decarbonizing two large sectors that contribute to climate change, right? Over 50% of greenhouse gas emissions are due to electricity and transportation. So being able to decarbonize those two sectors and putting them on a schedule of an accelerated decarbonization based on legislation and requirements path, I think is going to be very critical, and I hope they're able to achieve that. And I also think, you know, not losing sight of, it's always when we're moving forward and fast with programs, not losing sight of what are the blind spots. I remember working on a program in Brazil where they had an accelerated schedule for decarbonizing and renewable energy, and all of a sudden looked around and said, well, we don't have the labor force to be able to implement that at the schedule we're looking at because we haven't got people trained to do it. So making sure that we also have the training program and the educational programs and the pipelines to have the qualified workforce, and of course the just transition in terms of making sure that there's environmental justice in where those technologies are located, but also that you've got training programs to bring people from those areas into the new jobs. For instance, the Navajo, right? The Navajo reservation had the four corners where they've got several large-scale coal power plants that just shut down because they're not economic anymore in the West. There's a lot of people that had good jobs working in those power plants. So the issue is we should have more renewable energy developed in that territory, which is New Mexico, Arizona, and Colorado and Utah, and ensure that those people have jobs in the new industry. It'd be easy to retrain them, and we should be installing solar and wind energy in Utah, New Mexico, and Colorado. And all of these states, incidentally, now have higher renewable energy portfolio requirements. So it's a good synergy and a good coincidence, but we do need to be deliberate and very focused on how we do it.
Angelina, I think this was a great overview of what has happened in Texas. What are the learnings from that in conclusions? But also, it was a very good update on US Joe Biden administration and the first steps of this administration. I'm really much looking forward to our next conversation, hopefully soon, with new and more updates. So yeah, thank you very much, Angelina.
Yes, as we get closer to the summer and we start identifying the operational restraints and requirements, it'll be good to have a conversation before the summer and then during and after the summer to see how everybody performed, because these summer months are the most challenging for operating the grid, as you know. So we need to be prepared and we need to ensure that we don't have any glitches that were unanticipated and everything is online and operating as it should be, including the new storage that we have. I'll just, before we end, say that we had about 500 megawatts of storage last year in terms of battery storage in California. By the end of June, we're expecting to have 1,700 megawatts, so quite an increase. And I've been going to some ribbon-cutting ceremonies for large-scale battery storage projects, which are being built right now and put into operation throughout California. So that's also very exciting. It's happening very fast.
Great. We are very much looking forward to that, and keep up your own energy as well in this whole game. And I'm very much looking forward, and our listeners and audience as well, to our next update on US energy and climate policies.
Always. Thank you so much, David. Have a great evening.
Thank you. You too, Angina. Bye-bye.
Thanks again for tuning in. We hope you'll join us next time on Let's Talk Change. We are proud to be powered by DWR Eco, an international clean tech consultancy for business strategies, communications, and public affairs.